And that brings us to our last case of this morning, Carlos Williams v. Buss. Ms. Miklos?
May it please the Court, my name is Kelly Miklos, and I'm from the Indiana Attorney General's Office, and I represent the appellant Edward Buss, superintendent of the Indiana State Prison. This Court should reverse the District Court's judgment granting Williams habeas relief because his petition was untimely, his claim for relief is barred by procedural default, and is otherwise without merit. Williams asks this Court to excuse his untimely filing, his procedural default, and allow him a new trial based upon the following two facts without further analysis or application: that the Social Security Administration labeled him as mentally retarded for the purposes of receiving benefits, and that his defense counsel cross-examined a witness, a former client, who owed the attorney outstanding legal fees. The District Court granted relief based upon these two facts and at the same time acknowledged that the grant of equitable tolling was on a very slender reed. He made no finding that any mental deficiencies were related to Williams' late filing and made no finding of a conflict of interest, possible or actual, but rather had very strong concerns regarding a possible conflict of interest.
Ms. Miklos, let me ask you a preliminary question about the tolling period itself. I know the District Court was looking at this 13-day period, but when Mr. Williams was filing his post-conviction or was pursuing his post-conviction relief in Indiana State Court, things went off the rails when he files with the Indiana Court of Appeals, right? And he doesn't have the right appendix, and the court says, okay, you have another 30 days to file that, and it actually waits till something like day 96 before it dismisses. So my question is whether the state's position is that the countable time ends with the trial court level in Indiana because there was never any properly filed petition even at the Court of Appeals level, or whether you're willing to look at the proceeding before the Indiana Court of Appeals as properly enough filed, you know, to toll the running of the statute of limitations.
I think in this case, the Attorney General has looked as though it has been a properly pending state post-conviction petition up until the Indiana court dismissed it with prejudice.
Okay, because then we get into maybe a different problem, because as I understand Indiana law, the decision of an appeals court isn't final until it's certified by the clerk, and that doesn't happen until the time for transfer has expired. Now, of course, he doesn't apply for transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court, but if the time all the way up till the time for transfer expires, then maybe the problem isn't timeliness here. Maybe the problem is an O'Sullivan against Burkle kind of problem, because I don't know when the Indiana Supreme Court ever had the opportunity to rule on the questions that he's now talking about. I don't think he had that one full round through the Indiana courts. But I guess there's this issue, though, about which date do you use from the Indiana Court of Appeals for the final moment at which this thing is pending in that court.
There is a 30-day period where a litigant can seek discretionary review. And so in this case, if we give him the 30 days, then in fact his petition would be timely.
That's what I thought. And then, as I said, it probably just tosses him into a different set of problems. But
in our position on that, first of all, that the appellee has waived that. He raised it for the first time here in appeal and, in fact, conceded before the district court that he was 13 days late. In addition, in Fernandez v. Stearns, I think it addresses the situation where a litigant does not take advantage of a time to seek discretionary review, and that time the post-conviction petition is not pending. And looking at whether a petition is...
Which is that case, Fernandez?
B. Stearns, 227 F3D 9.
From Indiana?
Seventh Circuit. I'm not sure if it's from Indiana.
I would think personally that as a federal court, we should follow the law of the state to see when that state thinks each level of its own courts has finished with a particular case, and it's possible Illinois may say one thing, Indiana may say something else, and that's why waiver to one side, it seems to me it's possible this thing was never properly before the Indiana Court of Appeals at all, in which case he's way late. It's possible that because Indiana says the clerk can't certify until that 30-day period is over, he's not late, but he never asked for transfer, and so he's out on O'Sullivan. Or it's possible that somehow or another, I'm not quite sure how, one might actually reach the merits of his claim.
And I think if when we're looking at whether a post-conviction petition is pending is different than when we're looking at whether or not a review is final. Those are two separate reviews. And just because something may be final at a particular point does not necessarily mean under the statute that a post-conviction petition is pending during that time, especially in a case where a litigant does not take advantage of the time to seek discretionary review.
No, I understand that. It's just what with the lack of certification by the clerk is what I'm focusing on. And you wouldn't have to do it that way, but Indiana Appellate Rule 65E seems to say this.
And that's more just a matter of, I think, common sense, that if the litigant has 30 days to seek further review, then there is nothing for a lower court to act on.
Oh, but that's not at all the way we work things. You know, this court issues decisions and the mandate issues 2 weeks later, and if somebody wants to file a petition for cert, they're welcome to do it, but they have 90 days. Our mandate goes out long before the time for seeking cert.
And I think just because Indiana courts decide, you know, we're going to have a holding period and wait just to give the litigant time to decide, I don't think that necessarily translates into habeas that that therefore the post-conviction petition is still pending under the definition of the statute.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about the merits on a just-in-case basis?
On the merits regarding the conflict of interest?
Right.
I see that I'm in my...
You can save it for rebuttal if you want.
Okay.
Your time.
I will save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Parkinson?
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Parkinson, by court appointment for Carlos Williams, the appellee. I suppose I should start by addressing a few of the points that have been brought up here before court today, Your Honor. Yeah, as a matter of fact, we did raise in the district court the timing of the post-conviction relief petition and argued in before the district court, as we've argued here in our brief, that if you count it pursuant to the Indiana rules and cases, which the federal courts are bound to recognize procedurally, if you count it in that regard, then Mr. Williams' petition for habeas relief before the federal court was, in fact, timely. We never conceded that the petition was late. What we did say that if the... You talk about equitable tolling, not counting that second procedural argument, that is the one on the petition for post-conviction relief, that in that case it would be at most, given the mailbox rule, 13 days late. Judge Sharp, when he had issued his opinion, referenced Day versus McDonough, which says that the statute of limitations is not jurisdictional, and furthermore, the court on its own authority can assess whether or not a petition is late or not late, and Judge Sharp made reference to that in his opinion, and for good reason.
It's not, even if we gave you timeliness, and I'm not sure how that would come out, why isn't this case one that has to be dismissed under O'Sullivan?
Cause and prejudice analysis, as we brought before the district court, Your Honor, and as we state in our brief here, Mr. Williams had two causes here. First of all, in his letters to the Indiana Court of Appeals on his post-conviction relief petition, he said he didn't have access to the law library.
But those are arguments that the Indiana Supreme Court is fully capable of hearing and redressing if it thinks that the Indiana Court of Appeals was precipitous in dismissing or was being too picky about appendices or was in any other way doing something procedurally wrong. The Indiana Supreme Court can fix the procedural problem and send it back to the Court of Appeals to adjudicate the merits.
Sure, but if he didn't have access to the law library to know the appellate or petition proper necessity for petitioning for transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court.
But, you know, that argument goes too far because the Supreme Court of the United States has told us in O'Sullivan that this is simply a step that has to be taken. It doesn't say unless you're a pro se and you don't know about it. It just says this is a step that has to be taken.
Yes, and if it's not taken, it's procedurally default. But under the cause and prejudice analysis,
there's procedural default.
I'm saying there's an issue of procedural default. I'm saying that procedural default can always be overcome by cause and prejudice. The cause in this case is the one cause is he said he didn't have access to the law library, which is a constitutional right. If he didn't have that, how could he prepare a petition to transfer? And that's on the record. The second cause is the cause that is an actual the same issue as the prejudice in this case. The United States government declared this man to be mentally retarded as of 1988. And this distinguishes his claim from so many other claims for procedural default and otherwise, where somebody claims, well, I'm mentally incompetent or I'm emotionally unstable. Here you have the government declaring him mentally retarded. And these are brought before Judge Sharp, and he, in his opinion, did not discount those.
Now, even if we got to the merits of this conflict claim, why isn't it absolutely clear on this record that Mr. Williams waived the conflict? It seemed to me trial counsel was very responsible. He brings the conflict to the attention of the trial court as soon as he is alerted to the fact that there's, you know, here's this witness who's going to come, and there's the prior relationship, and there's the fee issue. He discloses everything. There's a discussion on the record. Mr. Williams says, this is all okay with me. Why isn't that the end of that argument?
Oh, he didn't waive it.
It was all right at the time. Contemporaneously, he says,
You're talking about in the trial transcripts,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Yeah. That's the relevant time.
It has to be a knowing and intelligent waiver, and here we get back to the mental incompetency issue. Also, this key witness was presented the very morning of the hearing, in which there was kind of flurry between the counsel, his client, the court, as to what the next step is to take. Things were kind of rushed through. That's not knowing intelligent under U.S. versus Aitkins, 274 Fed 3rd 444. Also, under Hall versus United States, cited in the materials, prejudice is presumed if there's an actual conflict of interest. Here, we have a case where an attorney is cross-examining the key witness, and on the record, he's acknowledging that that key witness owes he, as an attorney, money or prior attorney fees. That kind of actual conflict of interest, I argued before the district court and I argue here, raises serious questions, very serious questions, about the competency and the fairness of the trial, where an attorney has an inherent interest in not alienating the key witness against his client.
Excuse me, Mr. Parkinson, but what could a conflict-free counsel have done that this counsel didn't do? Well, there was fairly extensive cross-examination of this.
Well, we don't know that, Your Honor. As I said, when there's an actual conflict of interest, an actual conflict, which this is, where the attorney has a vested interest in not wanting to alienate an adverse witness, and a vested interest certainly would be, I want money from this guy, and he owes me money, then prejudice is presumed. What would another counsel have done? Postpone the trial? Depose the witness? Try to get more information? We don't know. There's one other minor point, if I could, Your Honors, bring up. Under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 10, on Circuit Rule 10, a record can't be supplemented if it wasn't in the trial court record. There were materials brought into this court which counsel for the respondent said, told Judge Sharp, were not in any way meant to prejudice, was just meant to supplement the record. We objected. U.S. versus Banks in this court, 405 Fed 3rd, 559, makes it clear that you can't supplement the record with materials that weren't already there to the extent that a respondent would be trying to argue or use those supplementary materials to the prejudice of Mr. Williams. I think that's disallowed both under the rule, disallowed under the handbook. The extent they're accepted, they can't be used to bring up new arguments that weren't raised in the district court. And if there are no further questions, Your Honor, I thank the Court for its time.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Parkinson. Ms. Miklos, anything further?
Three quick points. One is the defendant never claimed that he was denied access to the law library. He just had limited access, and that's in the Court of Appeals order, the Indiana Court of Appeals order in the appendix. In addition, mental retardation, this court has addressed that in Harris v. Micadori, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and found specifically that mental retardation, where that litigant was borderline mentally retarded, did not justify cause to excuse procedural default. And in addition, the actual conflict that is alleged, there is no conflict.
He wants money from this guy. I don't know whether that's going to make him cross-examine aggressively or whether he's going to take it easy because he's hoping that payment will be forthcoming, but there's a financial relationship between the two.
There is a relationship, yes, but it doesn't meet the two requirements that the prior representation was substantially and particularly related, nor was there any confidential information gained from one case to the other, could be used for the other. In addition, I think just because there's a relationship, it's pure speculation that there's an actual conflict there. And even if there is an actual conflict, there still has to be an adverse effect on the adequacy of the representation. And there's never been any suggestion that the representation was jeopardized or that there could have been something done that wasn't done.
Suppose that the lawyer had owed, or suppose that the judge owed money to the lawyer. The judge sold the lawyer his car, and the lawyer hasn't finished paying for it. Do you really think that lawyer could continue just because it doesn't deal with the prior case?
Yes, I think based upon the particular circumstances that they could continue.
The judge would have to recuse, or the lawyer would have to get out of the case. The judge isn't going to hear a case from somebody who owes him money, or to whom he owes money, I'm sorry.
I think, I was looking at it from the attorney's standpoint.
But the point is, it's a mutual, it's a relationship, right? So the conflict sits there in the middle of the relationship.
Yes, there's a difference between saying that there is some sort of conflict, there is a relationship, that there's an actual conflict that would prejudice then the current client. And in this case, we can look at what the attorney said, which is, it's not a factor for me. I can cross-examine this witness, and I think, I'm sorry, I can't remember the case offhand, but that is something that is appropriate to look at, is the attorney's representation of whether or not a conflict exists. There are no further questions.
All right. The case will be taken under advisement. And Mr. Parkinson, you were appointed, and we thank you very much for your assistance to the court. We will stand in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.